common sense would lead you to believe that water, when you go below the dew point, will automatically go from vapor phase to liquid phase. It does not. You have to help it. Almost every little tiny droplet of water that happens by going from the vapor phase to the liquid phase first forms around a particle of dust. So if you've got a lot more dust because of a lot more pollution in the atmosphere, you develop a whole lot of very small water particles. Those are the white clouds that you don't normally see. The black clouds are the ones where the water droplets have coalesced into great big droplets. The white clouds are the ones that are highly reflective. So because of more pollution, we're making a lot more white clouds, which are reflecting more of the solar energy back into space. That's what's creating what looks like dimming of the sun. The satellites that we got above the atmosphere are showing the sun is still cranking out the same amount of illumination it always has, with a slight amount of variation up and down during the solar cycles, the 11-year cycles or the 22-year cycle, if you include the complete cycle of both polarities. So I don't believe we're getting less illumination, Mel. As I said, this NOVA program on the dimming of the sun makes it fairly clear that we're getting less illumination on the Earth, therefore less heating because of the pollution phenomena. At the same time, we're getting global warming from the things that create global warming, the so-called greenhouse gases. These two effects are fighting each other. The total amount of real global warming is greater than we think. Let me drop. The prediction is that when we... when we do a better job of eliminating pollution, and therefore we don't get as much dimming, we're going to get a much bigger dose of global warming. That's what people are predicting as a result of that particular NOVA program. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, I went and took a look at the where they said they saw this particular comment about the sun being darker or whatever, or less energy or less temperature of the sun. If you look at QRZ, that's where they said to look, and I did take a look at QRZ.com, you'll see it on the opening page about the mortar of the sun, Dick. Take a good quick look, if you can, at that. That's where the comments came from over.
Okay, my assistant is going to that website right now. Weather and sunspot cycle 24 heralding a new Maunder minimum or an ice age. Okay? Have to read a little bit more about that. So, I think that Maunder minimum, which I think occurred in the 1600s, whether or not that was caused by the pollution, places like the United Kingdom, where people were burning coke and peat and all kinds of stuff that was putting a lot of pollution in the atmosphere. I know that the air in many of the UK communities around that time was reasonably polluted. So I'm asking the question as a result of seeing this NOVA program on the dimming of the sun. Was it pollution caused? I will admit, though, that the Maunder minimum did show you a significant number of years where there were very, very few sunspot cycles. So the sun does go up and down in its solar cycle as to the amount of X-rays which hits the atmosphere and gives us the ionosphere. So during the minimum number of sunspots, when it's the minimum number of X-rays and the minimum number of, what am I looking for now? the mass expulsions of the sun. Do we also get them during that period of time, a kind of cooling? Darn interesting question. I'm going to have to read this. Glad you brought it to my attention. Thank you, Mel. Go ahead, Glenn.
I just wanted to make a small comment about some contacts that I've been making recently on 10 meters. This afternoon, contacts with Georgia. I mean, just this afternoon, I spent maybe about a half an hour. I made not to Europe, but certainly well within the United States and up and down the coast pretty easily.
Is it possible that some of those contacts you're making, Glenn, are by way of sporadic E propagation. Go ahead.
Yes, I definitely think so, Dick. And also, I noticed also some, there's, definitely things happen during the gray line period also. There again, I think having a vertical antenna up somewhere between, like, the 35 to 50 feet, you know, you can make contact out there, but I haven't really heard anything from Europe. Actually, not today I didn't, but, you know, over the last month or so, you know, occasionally they come in and out. So, I mean, if you want to work on 10 meters, the antenna isn't that large. And to get something for 10 meters up at, you know, say, like 40 feet vertical, you know, sideband operation is 24, I don't think it's really all that difficult to make contact there.
Boy, you're giving us a strong confirmation of what Dick and Mel have been saying for some time. A pure vertical antenna at an altitude can give you a lot of performance. Give us a quick description of your particular vertical antenna mounted at 40 feet that you're using on 10 meters. Now back to you, Glenn.
Sure, Dick. It's a beam antenna. It's a basically a two-element beam on 10 meters. It's a Cushcraft MA5B, which is normally designed for horizontal mode, but I have an elevator motor that's connected to the boom, so it allows me to switch between vertical to horizontal polarization or anywhere in between. So what I've been doing, tuning around on the flat side, but what I've been noticing, especially like today, everything is on the vertical polarization. And, so I was able to make, within about a half an hour time, 10 solid contacts. And they drift in, they drift out a little bit, and that's generally what I've been using there.
Glenn, do you get QEX magazine? Boy, I hope the answer is yes. Go ahead, Glenn.
No, I don't, Dick, but maybe I should. K4RIW, KC2, QIQ.
By hook, by crook, by steel, somehow get yourself a copy of the August issue, the July/August issue, 2008, QEX magazine. On page 47, there is this rather well-written article by Eric Nichols, KL7 Alpha Juliet, Kilo Lima 7 Alpha Juliet, who lives in Alaska. It's called the Goofy Foot Yagi, Two Element Yagi. And that's what you're running, a two-element Yagi on 10 meters. He wants to build it on 40 meters. But still, a two-element Yagi with super close spacing, a tenth of a wavelength spacing between the director and the driven element. Common sense would lead you to believe if you're only building a two-element Yagi, you're going to get the biggest bang for the dollar out of a driven element and reflector. Good common sense, dead wrong. You get a lot more bang. You get quite a bit more bang for the dollar with a single director very closely spaced. He's getting a skosh over 7 dB over isotropic gain with a two-element Yagi. So you want to get a hold of, as I said, July-August issue, 2008, QEX magazine. By hook or by crook, there's got to be some way somebody's going to burn you a copy of this. Page 47 through page 49. And I've had a few emails already with this, Mr. Eric Nichols on this particular antenna. Looks like he's got a lot of performance there. And as a two-element Yagi, you would love it. The slight disadvantage is the impedance match is tough. This antenna has got a lot of gain potential, both by modeling and real experiments. And he goes into the experiments he's conducting at this time. That's the good news. The bad news is the antenna has got an impedance of a little bit over 3 ohms resistive, and I think it's 62 ohms capacitive. So as an impedance matching device, it represents a bit of a challenge. But as you guys know, I have been jumping up and down for 3 solid years, telling people if you're willing to adjust the length of the driven element, you can get any value of resistive impedance you want. Will it still be effective on the goofy foot Yagi, super close spacing? Will that phenomena that I've been advocating still work? I'm trying to twist Eric's arm, KL7AJ. I've now sent him 2 or 3 emails twisting his arm saying, when you do the NEC modeling, NEC-2 modeling, can you extend that element of the driven element length to get a better impedance match and then go back and readjust the driven element spacing and length to get the gain back again. Will it let you do that if you slowly sneak up on it? And I'm waiting with bated breath to
repeater, timeout, cancel.
I'm waiting with bated breath to find out if the answer is yes. If so, one of my clients is jumping up and down saying, I've got to have that performance of a particular product that they are developing on some very different frequency range. But they're hoping that this phenomena is true. So back to you, Glenn, for any fill on that. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. No, I'm going to definitely get a copy of that. I'm kind of familiar with that antenna also, and I've kind of shied away from it specifically because of the impedance issue. But my strong belief is that you're right on the money, that if you take the element and increase the length, you get a much better match, or at least to a point where you can use a broadband remote tuning device near that element. That performance probably is going to come back. But there again, maybe I can try it at a higher frequency range and give you that answer as well. I'll try, granted, I'm not going to try it at 40 meters, though, that's for sure. That's why I don't see it right here.
Yeah, he's somewhere buried in the middle of Alaska. And his whole definition of success is an antenna that's got maximum gain. He doesn't give a darn about front-to-back ratio. To him, if he's getting QRM from the back of his antenna, it'll make him happy as all hell. Because his biggest problem in Alaska is nobody points their antennas in that direction. They think it's a barren wasteland and there are no hands there. And so he's hearing all kinds of signals that won't answer him unless he's really potent and he can aim a lot of signal back down their throat and get into their backlobe, so to speak. So forward gain is all he cares about. And he, as he says in the article, he's waiting for the snow to clear off his ground so he can start these experiments on 40 meters. You could do a beautiful testing in your laboratory on 10 meters, and depending on what the results are, I want to apply it to an even higher frequency. Okay, fun stuff. You ain't heard the end of this, the IDS thing. I believe this antenna, with a little lengthening of the driven element and proper retuning of that first director, it is my belief you'll get the gain back and you'll get a much friendlier impedance match. I still think the bottom line, though, is it's going to be a narrow band antenna. But will it cover enough of the 10-meter band to keep you happy? That's an interesting question, because if you don't succeed in making the impedance match better, 3 ohms resistance, 62 ohms of reactance, is a standing wave ratio of 42:1. And there's somebody who chimed in earlier, and I should have mentioned that, about Walt Maxwell, W2DU. We amateurs really misunderstand standing wave ratio. We think standing wave ratio means efficiency. In many cases, it does not. Your simple dipole, which has 70 ohm impedance to it, half-wave dipole, high up in the air, 70 ohm impedance, you're feeding it with 70 ohm line, or an impedance match with 70 ohm, you think that now you've got a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. You do on the transmission line. Inside the dipole itself, you're running a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio. It is a standing wave structure. Signal has to bounce back and forth. You and I call that resonance. You resonate first, then you radiate. I wish I had read that in some respected book. I'm hoping sometime in the future we will. Mel and I are going to have to publish that wider and better. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Sir. I've heard it a number of times. This is K2KEY. Yeah, get a chance, like I say, look over that article on the sun and see what you think about whether the sun really has different. Now, we're talking about measured right at the sun, the output of the sun, not worrying about air pollution and things like that. It's not factoring that in. And, yes, there was a terrible amount of pollution over like the UK during the 19th century and all. But they said the mini ice age that were created in that period of time was because of the cooling of the sun. how much truth there is in this, I don't know, Dick. But if you just peruse through that article on QRZ, what you think of their reasoning is I think it's quite interesting, over.
I intend to read that one, Mel. May not get a chance to do it tonight. I think you're saying you got more than one email on that exact subject. Go ahead. And by the way, one other thing I want to mention is that you and I are telling people that a vertical antenna, full half-wave dipole, is capable of tremendous performance that we average amateurs have not tapped into. The fact that it's a full half-wave, the fact that it's vertical, and the fact that it's up in the air. You put those three combinations together. Glenn is discovering that during so-called dead man conditions, he's making contact. If you have a marginal performance, very expensive, quarter-wave ground plane vertical antenna, flat on your lawn in your backyard, because you spent a lot of dollars for it, because it's shiny, fancy-looking, you think you've got a high-performance antenna, might not be true. A simple wire dipole, vertically strung, in the tree in the backyard, might be a hell of a lot higher in performance. That's sort of what Glenn is telling us. So during dead band conditions, if you've got the right equipment, you will talk to people. You'll be part of an exclusive club who have discovered this. You get a lot of pleasure in talking to people during a so-called dead band. And the other people with more conventional antennas in your county, in your neighborhood, in your town, are going to say, how in the world are you doing that? You put up the right kind of equipment, you're going to make two-thirds. That amateur in Japan, I can't forget his call letters right now, who has this five-element, fully rotating, 80-meter beam. He doesn't care if that band is dead, is closed. He opens that band when he feels like it. And when he goes away, the band shuts. He loans us that band when he's not there. I'm exaggerating a little bit. K2KEY, K2LAW.
KVHY.
Go ahead, Joseph.
Okay, I did some measurements. The interfering signal level coming out of the one port of the duplexer, which is connected to a beam antenna underneath the disc cone, is minus 52. I took a 3 dB attenuator and attenuator to match the R7000 and put that in series with the antenna line. The interference completely went away. I took the R7000 and put it on a different antenna closer to my station master, much closer than the disc cone is. Instead of being 15, about 20 feet away, it's like about maybe 2 foot because it's mounted on the same pipe. No interference produced with that antenna.
Okay. 3 dB of pad made a minus 52 signal, which is a pretty strong signal, thoroughly disappear. It did not go down by 3 dB. That strongly suggests, it's not perfect proof, but it strongly suggests R7000 is not making it as a direct emission. He's making it as a nonlinear reflection, as a passive intermod device. Something else is making that signal that you're seeing squittering. Interesting test. Back to you for comments on this, Joe.
And when I put the R7000 on a UHF Yagi beam, which is mounted about 2 feet underneath the station master with no attenuator, no interference was produced. So I put the receiving antenna closer to the transmitting antenna from my repeater. No interference was observed on the third device, which has a the duplexer on it. Only when I'm on this disc cone antenna with no attenuator on the R7000 and it's depowered, I get interference.
Yeah, the disc cone antenna is very broadband in azimuth of reception, very broadband in frequency. When you put the R7000 in the unpowered mode onto any other antenna, it's getting a different frequency region of signals. It's getting a different pattern of signals. You've made a significant change. You change the amplitude of the offending signal, just like the 3 dB pad did. So, the disc cone being so broad in azimuth and so broad in frequency allows the combination of frequencies to come in where he now mixes them together and makes that undesired product. That's what I think your measurement has suggested. It's starting to make a little more sense. What do you think, Joe?
I think I'll have to do some more measurements. I disconnected some other devices and with their respective antennas, and they made no difference, so they weren't part of the combination. So as at this point, I don't know exactly where it's coming from. From what you said, if the intermod would be truly not produced by the R7000 by putting a pan in there and it goes away completely or reduced significantly, it looks like that's not the offending device. It's just a contributing device.
You got it. He's the catalyst. He ain't doing it. He's the catalyst. He's the mixing diode. All of those crazy frequencies are getting into the R7000 when he's unpowered, and his mixing diode emitter base junction front end is finding a way of mixing them together and making the offending signal. So by way of the R7000 back in the circuit, so that the offending signal is there, you've now got to look on a super broadband spectrum analyzer connected to that antenna to find out what signals are there. And that's going to be hard because which are the offending ones and which ones are the innocent ones. You know, with your R7000 on top of a good location, into a good sensitive spectrum analyzer, you're going to see a zillion signals. It's kind of hard to know which combination is doing it. You'll eventually pin it down. You're making progress, and we're all learning something in the process. Well done, Joe. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Yeah, in fact, I wanted to make one comment that Glenn had mentioned about 10 meters. I run the 10-meter net on Sunday mornings at 11 o'clock on 28.380. And last week we had, where you were the guest caller, a band opening of some sort. And we had about 15 to 20, or maybe more, check-ins from stations, especially all of them down south, the Carolinas, Georgia, and Florida. So you do see these unusual band openings. I see more of it basically on 30 meters than I do on 10 meters. Now, I've always been, you know, sort of curious why the position of 30 meters seems to be more prevalent with unusual band openings on the last drop, such as a few weeks ago, one night a band opening to the really long band opening to the Pacific, working Australians, New Zealanders, Japan, Philippines, and all coming through extremely well. And then another night, it's the same situation many times with the Europeans. Other nights, it's just nothing. So this is, you know, not really, I can't call it anything to do with the sun, really, because let's face it, the solar count right now has been zeros now for weeks to take over.
Okay. We could all gnash our teeth and cry in our beer and be unhappy about the fact that the solar cycle is down at the basement and the bottom, and therefore the ionosphere is not being lit up by those sunspots, and therefore the long-range DX contacts on your favorite bands are not there. That's one approach. The other approach is, you've heard it so often, if somebody gives you a lemon, take lemonade. There's ways of taking advantage of this. You put up the right antenna at the right altitude with a sensitive enough receiver and a powerful enough transmitter. You're going to make QSOs on every one of those bands. You're going to make QSOs that your buddies don't make. When I put up that array of 16 Yagi on 432 megacycles on my 100-foot tower, and you can see a picture of it in the March issue of CQ Magazine, 2008. You see a picture of my antenna with me standing in the middle of it. You see another picture of me top-down on that tower, a crazy photograph. I was talking to people on the 432 meg band, single sideband, 480 miles away. My radio horizon is 43 miles away, 10 times beyond my radio horizon. I was talking to people. Did it for 4.5 solid years. For the first couple of years, people accused me of talking to myself. They didn't hear the other side of the conversation. They thought the guy I'm talking to is really on the telephone, and we were creating a hoax. And we did it for a half hour every Tuesday at 7:30 for 4.5 years. Can you imagine what a phone bill that would have run up? Those guys had to eat an awful lot of crow when they find out we were really doing it. You put up the right equipment, guarantee you're going to enjoy the results. No matter what antennas you've got, you build another one, you're going to like it. You'll never find a ham who said, I put up antenna number 2, 3, and 4, and I wish I hadn't done it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly, that's the answer, because on 10 meters, a number of the contacts that I've made in the last year, only operating very little, just basically the Sunday morning net. I was surprised a number of times, some of the check-ins. We've even had a couple of Europeans check in, and I'd be basically the only one to copy them, because having, I should say, the antenna, basically, that's the answer. I got 6 elements, wide space, 36-foot boom on 10 meters. And the altitude, of course, up at the top of the tower, and the location by the ocean, great receiver, no doubt, all contribute. But, you know, again, people have said to me, you know, they think I'll put it, you know, very nice, say that I'm pulling their leg, but a couple of times, just to prove the point, I got the QSL card, and there it is, distinctly on the QSL card, the contact information. So, I should say, it's possible. It takes patience and a lot of time, a lot of disappointment, but it can happen. And this is what I'm trying to answer to the number of these emails that take over.
Yeah, we amateurs, almost none of us build our transmitters or build our receivers anymore. We buy them. And if there's some particular feature in there you don't like, after you buy the receiver or transmitter, you make a modification. That's a reasonable thing to do. But there's so darn many transistors and integrated circuits and whatever in there, it's beyond the normal guy's capability. When Mel and I were first cutting our teeth, we built our own first transmitter and receiver. You don't do that anymore. But we still build our antennas. They're not that expensive in general. You can never have enough of them. The thorough understanding of how an antenna works, there's a lot of mystery still in there. There's a lot of magic to be investigated. Joe and Glenn and Paul and Mel and Dick and N2EO, we're all experimenting with antennas, and we're all finding out things that are quite often surprises. And you can never have enough of them. And even if you're putting more wire in your backyard and you're afraid it's going to look like a zoo up there, normal human beings don't see wire antennas. You can't have enough of them. And Bell has discovered ways with his green plastic-covered wire that he puts it in the tree in the front of his house, right against the street, and people do not see it. He can point it out to people, and he's got to be real careful as to how he points it out before they even see it. It's invisible, but it's a high performer. I mean the word high in two different ways. It's high up, and makes it perform, and it performs well. And it's vertically polarized. And it's a rare antenna. I don't know of any amateur book that I can open up right now that's going to show me a vertical half-wave dipole on HF frequencies strung in a tree, alongside of a tower, or whatever. The closest thing they come to it is a sloper. A vertical polarized sloper at a 45 degree angle or something like that. It doesn't have to be that way. Altitude always makes an antenna perform better. Get it away from the ground. You don't have to put 40,000 radials down to get high performance. Standing wave ratio tells you something about the way the transmission line is working. It tells you almost nothing about the efficiency of the antenna. I can have a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna. Let me drop. That's a quarter wave ground plane mounted on the ground in the backyard with a small number of radials. And a significant percentage of my RF energy is coupled into that Earth and heating up the Earth and not going into space. But the standing wave ratio meter will not tell you that. You look at the Vizsla meter, you think, gee, it's a perfect antenna. It looks pretty. It must be performing well. How come no one's answering me? It may not be the best antenna for you. Almost all of us have nearby buildings, trees, towers, flagpoles, all kinds of things we can mount a simple wire vertically polarized antenna onto it. The fact that it doesn't appear in the book, don't let that discourage you. Think out of the box, go do it. That's a suggestion. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Exactly. This is K2KEY. That's basically the bottom line. I keep giving them. I just said, put up as best you can, as high as you can, and get on the air. Stop worrying about, you know, every little wrinkle in the wire. In fact, I got a number of emails here about our tree antenna discussion, which you just alluded to, Dick. And the questions are as follows. Let's see. Let's look at one here. I was intrigued by this tree antenna situation. Are you sure that I will not make a fire in the tree, especially during the fall of the year when the leaves are drying out? Is there any possibility that I'm going to create a fire in the tree by this tree-mounted antenna? Take over.
Without a doubt, you can make a fire in the tree with that antenna. You put 50,000 watts into the antenna, run a key down for 6 solid minutes, and the antenna, the vertically polarized dipole, with 50,000 watts of RF into it, mounted a 1/8 of an inch away from the trunk of the tree, where the antenna arcs over to the tree, and you wait in the wintertime when the tree is dry, where it doesn't have wet sweat sap in it like it does in the summertime, and I give you a 50-50 chance you might be able to create a fire in that tree. The kilowatt that we run under normal conditions create a fire in the tree. It's good to be concerned. It's good to be conservative. The chances of you doing that, I mean, if I was a Boy Scout and I had no way to make a fire, but I had a kilowatt transmitter at my disposal and a tree, a dry tree, and I want to use that antenna, a dipole antenna, a kilowatt transmitter, and a tree to try to make a fire, boy, that would be tough. I think you might go hungry. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, or you'd be eating uncooked food. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. We'll go back to rubbing sticks together. No doubt, a more of a chance, definitely, to make a little fire. Yeah, very good, Dick. And I noticed, you know, I have a few of these, basically, almost asking the same question, because somebody did come on the TechNet and said that they had a arc over to the tree with their antenna in the tree. So it seems to have stirred up a number of these questions. Another one, in fact, here is that the question is that this antenna in the tree, isn't it going to create a lightning hazard? In other words, make it more possible for lightning to hit this tree, take over.
There is a slight increase on that one. Slight, very slight. We all worry about the metal we put up in the air being struck by lightning. And with a couple of exceptions, it almost never happens. Lightning strikes wherever it feels like. I will admit that it's going to strike the Empire State Building a lot more frequently than other things around it. Great big metal structure, the highest thing around. But it doesn't always strike the Empire State Building. There's a hell of a lot of things in Manhattan that lightning will strike. The biggest target you've got in your neighborhood is the power wiring, Con Ed and LIPA power wiring, New Jersey Power and Light. If you had the right kind of vision and you took a top-down photograph of your neighborhood, up and down every single block, all of those telephone poles, all of those pole pig transformers, all of those wires going into all of those houses, there's this huge grid of wires all over the place. That's the biggest target. 90-some-odd% of the time, and you get damage due to lightning, the lightning struck your 110-volt line. That's how it got into your house. Yes, do a job of grounding your antenna to protect your equipment from lightning. If there's a real severe lightning storm nearby, it is prudent to disconnect all the coax cables from your equipment and just leave them hanging outside the window, so to speak, if you can do it. Or disconnect them and connect them to nothing. You will give a little bit more protection to your equipment. And I will admit also, let me drop it, that with a kilowatt of power on a high Q antenna in a pine tree, where you've got these very dry, skinny little needles that are relatively easy to ignite, if I carefully took the tip of the dipole and put it right up against some of those pine needles and pour a kilowatt into it, I think I can make a fire. So if you're using a pine tree as a support, there are ways that you can suspend the wire such that the high voltage tip, the center of the dipole always has very low voltage. The tip is where the high voltage is. Be a little bit careful of whether or not the tips of the dipole go near the pine needles. You know, a 16th of an inch or a 32nd of an inch away from dry pine needles, I think you could excite a fire. But you take a maple tree, an oak tree. I guess in the fall, when the leaves are super dry and haven't dropped off the tree yet, could you make a fire? Yes, it's possible. Have you worried about that? What kind of tree is it in your front yard, Mel? And by the way, with the rubber insulation on the wire, you're giving it a lot less capability of doing this arc over process. Various amateurs have asked, hey, if I use 14-gauge household wire, should I remove the rubber or leave it on? Leave the rubber on for a whole bunch of reasons. And it doesn't affect the RF performance. So when it comes to fire potential, if you're running high power, now, it takes a kilowatt to do this. To try to make a fire in a tree with 100 watts of power, boy, that is tough. I wouldn't say it's impossible. I think it's pretty tough. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
No, this is a pine tree. This is K2KEY. It's about 70 feet tall, pine tree, and running a kilowatt into it. The only power I am running occasionally into, right, usually run 100 watts, but especially, well, 30 meters, I have that so-called sort of sloping cantilever type of antenna that we've discussed with the curved type of bottom section, somewhat vertical, and then curves down. That seems to work quite well. That's my 30-meter antenna that's hanging from the tree of about, at least around the 50-foot point off a branch around 50 feet. It does touch some of the branches of the tree, can't help that. The vertical I have, the 65-foot vertical, has PVC standoff from a number of branches, so it's, the whole thing floats fairly loose, and all, not really any part of it makes direct contact to the tree for the most part, because if you look up a pine tree right next to the main stalk, look at that, the way that a pine tree grows, you know, it grows with a very straight trunk, straight up. In fact, the way the branches come out, you can almost see a clear path right up almost to the top. So no problem to drop from the vertical section up on the top there, which is a lip up on top for the last, I'd say six up about 8 feet above the top there, and then drop down the wire straight down to ground, where my radials, the 100 radials are buried. That's 65-foot, basically a 65-foot vertical I use. And I do run occasionally a kilowatt into that antenna, and so far, this is over a number of years, I've had no problem. Let me let it drop. I'll make another comment.
Yeah, I've got a comment on this too. Go ahead.
Okay. Also hanging off that tree is the 40-meter vertical. Well, I guess we'll call it somewhat of an inverted V type of configuration, because the V point is up hanging off a pulley that was pulled up from another branch on the tree, and the coax does go up the I have the coax actually just fastened through a number of branches going up the tree very loosely just to keep it from really waving around. Everything is, in other words, loose. That's the whole answer. But, you know, if you tighten up anything, it's going to get into a hassle with that tree. When it wind blows, you know what's going to happen. Go ahead.
Okay. If it is a pine tree that I'm operating with, and if I'm a conservative amateur and I want to be super darn sure that I don't quite catch that tree on fire, you said some magic words. You've got some PVC tubing acting as a standoff. Recognizing the fact that only the tips of the dipole develop the high voltage, I can be careful on where I put the tips of the dipole so it's not near some pine needles that are easy to ignite. And near meaning, if I had to ignite pine needles, I think the tip of the dipole, I am guessing, would have to be closer than a half inch of air. And if I can put some insulating material in that half inch, the problem goes away. So if the tips of the dipole are encased in a length of PVC pipe, how we suspend the pipe, we haven't discussed it yet. But if I put it inside a PVC pipe as an insulator to make sure it doesn't have the ability to arc over the tree, I think I've created the safety factor that I need. I could also wrap the tips of the wire and the end egg insulators with the foam insulation that you put across the water pipe to make sure that it's thermally insulated. Choose the foam insulation that's made for a half-inch water pipe and find some way of fastening it to the wire near the tips of the dipole. So foam insulation or PVC pipe insulation, half-inch diameter, quarter-inch diameter PVC pipe over the wire, I think would give the protection we're worried about. So if we want to be super conservative and run a kilowatt into a dipole in a pine tree, I think with the right standoff technique and insulating technique, I think we can make it super safe. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW?
Exactly. That's what I got, a piece of PVC pipe. And the goes right up that foot hole, center of the vertical section that goes up above the top of the tree. Inside the PVC pipe is part of that vertical piece, and that PVC pipe is then secured through a number of branches, and then out of the bottom of the PVC pipe is the insulated wire that drops straight down. Very straightforward, no mystery there, and that's for the vertical that I use on CW, and I've run a kilowatt into it a number of times, and no fires. So, as you say, it is pretty much unusual. First of all, a good, healthy pine tree is green all the time. And especially, you know, we don't have the drought situation here and everything. So the tree is not really like in a lot of places where they have these huge fires because the tree is so dried out because of drought conditions for long periods of time. So this is a healthy tree with good, healthy needles on it, green needles, so I don't think I'm going to have much of a worry about fire stick over.
Okay, let's go one step further. If I really want to be conservative, assume now it's a half-wave dipole fed at the bottom. Not fed in the center. Although you could feed it in the center too, but in my simple example, I'm going to feed it in the bottom. And I buy gray-colored half-inch diameter PVC pipe of the right length, put it up tree with a string down the center. When the pipe has been fastened to the tree, the PVC pipe, I take the string at the bottom, tie it to the wire, go to the top of the tree, pull on the string, and notice to pull the wire up through the PVC pipe. Well, maybe I install it ahead of time, but one way or the other, I install the PVC pipe on the tree with the wire going down the center of the pipe, the PVC pipe. I think I've now got a very safe antenna. And I've also weatherproofed my dipole. Put an end cap on the end of the PVC pipe at the top, and not even weather goes down there. Not even ice gets a chance to form with water and whatever. That would make a very long-lasting dipole, insulated from the tree, and now even if the pine tree dies for its own reasons and becomes a very dry set of pine needles, somewhat like a Christmas tree. I mean, there's lots of stories of people who get a fire in the house from a Christmas tree. And so those pine needles are very burnable. So even if the tree dies because of the PVC pipe, I think you've just about canceled all the fire hazard capability. Do you think it's a construction that could be built without a whole lot of extra effort and a lot of dollars? I think it could be fairly inexpensively built. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's no big deal there, Dick. I don't see any problem if just launching it up there. It's so straightforward. You know, when I show everybody that's interested, and I tell them, first of all, I stand there, they don't see it, and I walk them over and show them the right angle to look at them, and they say, oh my. And I said, that really works. I said, that worked phenomenally well. Now another couple of, I have some other emails here, about putting it into oak trees and some of these maple trees. And I tell you, I don't see any reason why you can't take a maple tree, which a lot of maple trees around. I have another tree in the front of the house that's further out, that's a regular, you know, city tree, maple tree. And I've looked at that, and I see that you can hang a vertical section of an antenna from a high branch, and then you could locate the radio, just put the radios, actually use the branches that, you know, branch out in all different directions, and with the insulated wire, I don't see any reason that you cannot use the branches to support the radios. And the problem, of course, only problem you have is with the feed line coming across. You know, if you run moderate power, like 100 watts, you can use the mini ATU or whatever. And I don't think it would be much of a problem. I don't see any, you know, really that it would be something easily detectable, over.
Hey, you're describing a quarter-wave ground plane vertically polarized antenna with ground plane radials. Those ground plane radials are another quarter wavelength long, and the branches might be long enough to tolerate that. I think you get a lot more for your money not running the radials. Just run one radial straight down. Now it's a full half-wave dipole, straight in the center. That's the best radial in the world. One radial straight down, and the whole structure is above the ground. So you could do it, make a set of radials going out the branches, and you wouldn't have to string a whole lot of them, because this is the one case where the whole antenna is above the ground, therefore it can't easily couple its RF energy into the ground, which is the lossy medium that sucks it up, turns it into heat. So, do you build a ground plane up in the tree, or a vertical half-wave dipole? I would choose a half-wave dipole. Maybe do both and compare the results. A dry oak tree or maple tree in November, when there's still a few very dry leaves hanging on the tips of those branches, do they represent a fire hazard? Boy, I think it would take a lot of power to make it happen. It'd be a comedy of errors, of a real close spacing right at the tip where the voltage is the maximum, right at a nearby leaf, and the leaf is right against a branch that is still conductive, and you're arcing over through the leaf into that branch and create fire on that one leaf. And could that burn down the tree? I won't say it's impossible, but wow, that looks like a very low probability event. What do you think, Mel?
Well, the only reason that I would hesitate to put a vertically polarized dipole like out in that maple tree, because the end of it would come down, you know, the tree is right on the edge of the sidewalk. The pine tree has been on my property, set back about 15 feet back into my property, where on my lawn, whereas with the maple tree that's out on the sidewalk situation, I wouldn't want the wire to actually come down and actually be tied to a spot where anybody walking by could actually touch a dick. So that's the only reason. That's why I suggested that if you wanted to go to more of a ground plane configuration, that you can keep the wires, the radio wires, you know, way up there, you know, up high enough, and just, you know, branch them out if they're, especially if the limbs are long enough, for like bands like 20 meters, 30 meters is easily achieved. I don't say it's going to be an easy proposition to do that if you want to go to like 80 meters. However, if the tree is high enough, you can drop that wire down and still be, you know, good distance above anybody being able to touch it. And then if there's a number of trees, you know, many streets have a lot of trees on it, and when one is basically right next to each other, there's, you know, a whole reason that you can't sort of clandestine, as they say, sneak them into the, you know, the next tree, let them cross from one tree to another. And with that green, like green wire that I'm using, you'd be hard pressed to be able to see that thing over.
WS2N.
Paul recognized, but first I've got two suggestions. Yeah, the half-wave dipole, purely vertical in a tree, where the bottom of the dipole comes close to street level, and people can walk over and touch it, that is not good. There's at least two or three ways you can solve that problem. Number one, raise the dipole higher. Maybe you don't have enough tree to do that, but there's nothing magic about keeping the upper half of the dipole completely straight piece of wire. You can zigzag it in all kinds of ways to make the center of the dipole higher up. Now the bottom of the dipole is higher, and zigzag the bottom too. So by zigzagging and curving it over at right angles in certain places, there's all kinds of ways you can get the dipole higher above the ground on the bottom portion so that people don't touch it. But even if it is close to the ground where people could touch it, you can encase that portion of it in a piece of PVC pipe. Paint it the right color so that it doesn't show up like a sore thumb against the tree. So that now the wire is inside the PVC pipe, people can't touch that wire. It's pretty safe. Let's see what Paul's going to say. WS2N, HURIW.
Okay, yeah, I was thinking about the ends of the dipole. You know, you said the very tips of the dipole would be the points where you would have the highest voltage. Out of all my dipoles I've ever put up, I always have insulators on, you know, on the end. So I, there is no like tip. You know, I'll take a wire and I'll go around an insulator and I'll twist it back on onto itself, and then put another wire or some type of rope or whatever on the other end of the insulator that the thing goes to the tree. So, I don't know, there really is never an end. It's always like a loop. I mean, there's an end, but it's twisted, you know, back onto itself there. So, I don't think that would really be a problem. You'd have to have this dipole straight out somehow, pointing into the trees. Unless you're saying right off the end, even where it's curved, it could arc over. Maybe that's a possibility. Back to you, Dan.
Yeah, the end of the dipole that's bent around the eye of that egg insulator, or a dog bone insulator, whatever it's called, that end, although it's curved, which gives you much less tendency to arc, if I made that within a 16th of an inch of a highly conductive object that's grounded, tree with a lot of sap in that particular branch, and in between that 16th of an inch, I've got a dry, dry leaf, and I pump a kilowatt into that antenna. Even that portion that's curved through that insulator, I possibly could create an arc. And I could strike that light leaf on fire, possibly, with great difficulty, but it's possible. But there's all kinds of ways you can protect that. PVC pipe is one of them. All kinds of ways you can stand that section off from the tree. And Mel has done some of those standoff practices. K2KEY, HURIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. It's very simple to do, I should say. Now, for instance, like on the 30-meter, that's sort of sloping, concave type of dipole, I realized that the end of the dive could be a problem child. So I got a length of PVC pipe. That's my end insulator. No, I'm not using a glass, door foam insulator. What I've got is a length of PVC pipe, and the end of the dipole picture goes in, and the PVC pipe is about, I'd say 3 foot long, and maybe less than that, 2 feet long. I don't know. I had a scrap piece, 10 feet of pipe that it was, I found, basically. I'm always picking. I think with pipe, anyway, where they're made out of plastic, out of iron, if I see a piece of pipe, I always envision doing something with it. I got a whole pipe yard in the back here. Behind the garage, I got a storage area, and there's a pipe yard there that you'd get a kick out of the pipes of every size, length, diameter, material. But I took a piece of this PVC pipe a few feet long, and the dipole goes up inside to the PVC pipe, so it's in about 6 inches or so towards the other end of the PVC pipe. Where there, I drilled holes on both sides and tied it off, with a plastic tie in there. I made a loop through it, and then I actually made a loop through the end of the dipole, or I think you would make an eye, pushed it through to that point where that hole is, pushed a tie in through that loop and through the both ends of the pipe, and then the pipe, the 6 inches more of the pipe is where I drilled another hole, and another tie goes through there, and that's what hangs it to the branching there. So that's how I basically have the end of the dipole so-called protected against possibility of any kind of arcing over.
That's very crafty, particularly if those ties are the black ones that are UV protected. Mel, have you considered sending that in for technical topics or hints and kinks of QFC? That is a beauty. Go ahead.
I guess you can send it in. I'll tell you, it's a lousy light and I'm going crazy here. I try to answer a number of emails, and I'll tell you something. A lot of them are just hunting tech, and I try to answer the ones to these young people about rigs, purchasing the rigs and things. I got a lot of questions on that, about, which radio again, preference of the radio, preference of the options, and all that kind of good stuff. So I have a lot of problems with that, but you can take any of these ideas, Dick, and believe me, you can say that it was brought up on a TechNet, and you want to submit them. That these are, you get a lot of great ideas you hear on here, great innovation to adopt all kinds of ideas. So put us all together, and maybe just submit them and let them do whatever they like with it. They're part of participating with the TechNet over.
I don't know if I'm going to get a chance to do it. It's not on the top of my priority list right now. But that's not a difficult one to write. And a simple sketch, just to get the idea across to the QFT editors, they will clean up the diagram, they will clean up the English and whatever, before they put it in hints and kinks for technical topics. Not as difficult as you think to submit to them. I recommend you consider it. Now, when it comes to marketing surveys, of brand new ham radio equipment. In my opinion, that is not a fair question as a write-in question. Very unfair. And marketing surveys of old equipment is not a good write-in question. It's a good call-in question, live, verbally. Because when you call in as a ham radio operator, to this assembled group, and you say, gee, I'm thinking of buying the Kenwood 940, a rig that's been around for a lot of years, and I intend to use it for this particular service, and somebody is selling one on eBay for X number of dollars. Is that a good deal? Will it solve my problem? That is a fair question as a live verbal question, because that is a popular rig with a good reputation. A lot of people on frequency have real history with that rig. They can tell you everything they like about it, everything they don't like. They can tell you where the articles are on a piece of equipment like that to do modifications if you want to lower the ripple of the power supply or increase the sensitivity of the front end or whatever. So it's a rig that's got history. And to ask for, should I buy a Kenwood so-and-so or an ICOM such-and-such,